I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, a fresh look at the political trailblazer Shirley Chisholm. She was the first black woman to serve in the U.S. Congress, and now her 1970 memoir is being re-released. We'll talk to a filmmaker who knew her well about what we might learn from her life and her story and her career today. But first, we dig a little deeper into the Supreme Court's decision last week to overturn some longstanding laws in the area of campaign finance. Last Thursday, in a 5-4 vote on the case of Citizens United v. Federal Election Commission, the Supreme Court overturned a 63-year-old law and two of its own decisions that barred corporations and unions from spending money directly from their treasuries on ads that support or oppose candidates for president and Congress. Companies still cannot give money directly to candidates, and anybody who spends money on political ads must still disclose the names of contributors. But it's the change in the law that has gotten many Democrats and progressives upset, because they believe that the money raised by corporations will overwhelm the funds that other kinds of groups can raise and tilt the system inevitably in support of the interests of big corporations. That was the view expressed yesterday on this program by House Majority Whip James Clyburn, the number 3 Democrat in the House. Today, we wanted to reach out to two more voices to hear what they have to say. We're particularly interested on the potential impact on minority candidates. So we've called Angelo Falcone. He's the president of the National Institute for Latino Policy. Also with us is Linda Chavez. She's the chair of the Center for Equal Opportunity. I welcome you both. Thank you for joining us.
Great to be with you.
Linda, let me start with you. As we mentioned, we had Congressman Jim Clyburn on the program yesterday, and I just want to play a short clip of our conversation for those who missed it. Here it is.
If corporations that have deep pockets come into these campaigns and make it uncomfortable for elected officials to oppose some of their habits, then I think that you've got a problem. It is the first step toward fascism, and I think it is a dangerous escalation of corporate monopoly.
So, Linda, I'm interested in your perspective. I was particularly interested in calling you because you have been a candidate for elective office yourself. You ran for the Senate, the United States Senate in Maryland some years ago on the Republican ticket. What's your perspective on this? What do you think?
Well, first of all, I think that the Supreme Court decision was long overdue. The Constitution of the United States is pretty direct and unambiguous. Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. And the question is whether or not corporations, which are, after all, associations of individuals, should somehow be punished in ways that other types of associations are not. And I think the decision was a correct decision. I don't think it's going to have any kind of pernicious effect. And frankly, you know, there's been a lot of attention focused on corporate money that's now going to be used in these kinds of ads that are issues-focused or candidate-focused but are independent expenditures, but very little attention has been focused on the fact that labor unions are also able to run these kinds of ads. And labor unions, frankly, are well geared up to be able to do so, and I think they're going to have as much, if not more, influence in running.
Well, I'm interested why you say that, given that labor unions only represent maybe at most 12% of the workforce these days.
Well, they actually represent quite a bit less. They represent about 8%.
About 8%. So how is it possible that you think that their influence in the system would be equivalent to that of some major corporations?
Because they spend their money on elections. In fact, labor unions, I wrote a whole book about this back in 2004. Labor unions now exist primarily to promote political points of view. And in fact, they use their money, they use their staffs in elections in unprecedented ways over the last 20 years. And they are, I think, in many ways, less responsive to their members than corporations are to their shareholders. There aren't a whole lot of shareholders out there who are going to want to see corporate profits turned into political speech, except in very exceptional circumstances. And so I think you're going to have a lot more activity on the part of unions than a lot of people anticipate.
And just to clarify, I'm being told it's the unionized workers are some 7% of the workforce,
right,
and most
actually,
of its members
right.
are employed by the government. So just so that we're clear. Angela, what do you think about this? You wrote an opinion piece about this on your site. You said that the decision is, you said, while framed as an association of individuals, including nonprofit corporations and unions, the court's majority clearly ignored the problem of the concentration of corporate power and the fact that corporations have many ways they can express themselves through PACs and other means. You say it also ignores the growing economic inequality in the U.S. and its negative implications for the value of free speech and democratic politics. Tell us more about what you mean by that.
Well, that was very well said, well written. Thank you very much. I totally disagree with Linda in terms of the implication of this, because I think the issue is, is what is the role of corporations in society? How do you characterize the nature of corporations, the idea of making corporations equivalent to individuals, a natural being? It just doesn't make sense when we look at the kinds of tensions that we've seen in American society around the issue of corporate power and democracy. And I think there's been a set of precedents, decisions that have basically said that corporations are limited in terms of their rights in many ways, that they're not human beings and can't be the equivalent even through associations, that there's something special about corporations. And what the Supreme Court did was also very suspect in the way it happened. I thought it was very interesting when you look at Stevens' dissent, where he actually charged the majority with having a hidden agenda and having an agenda by actually kind of bringing this case in a very unorthodox way so that they could make this kind of decision. And also the fact that, you know, while I agree with Linda, I'm not sure what the ramifications are going to be. I mean, right now people are hyping it up from all different angles. It's either not going to have any impact or the United States is going to be totally destroyed as a result of this decision. I think the only fact I see is that this gives more power to corporations to influence elections, to influence the political process in a way that I think basically plays on these inequalities in this country. I was looking at it from the point of view of the Latino community, a community that's low income, that doesn't have much representation in the corporate sector, and how this is going to create even more challenges for groups like Latinos to get involved and have a say in the political process.
Let me just jump in just briefly to say, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. We're speaking with Linda Chavez of the Center for Equal Opportunity and Angelo Falcone of the National Institute for Latino Policy. We're talking about the Supreme Court's recent decision to overturn a previous campaign finance law that barred corporations and unions from making direct spending on ads that support or oppose candidates. And we're particularly interested on the potential impact on minority candidates. But Angela, you also go on to point out that Latinos represent $1 trillion worth of buying power in this country, and African Americans certainly represent a number equal to that amount. I mean, couldn't one argue that then perhaps these groups, if they're particularly concerned about having a political voice, need to reorient perhaps their spending priorities to put more effort into supporting or opposing political candidates?
Well, that's the problem. The problem is that right now, as a lot of people who have supported this decision point to, is that we have these regulations that really haven't been that effective at holding back corp power in terms of decision-making processes in terms of policy. What this does, it makes it even tougher to do that. I think it raises the ante in terms of how various communities, various political actors are going to have to kind of play a role to kind of offset this increased power, I think, that corporations are going to have. And so I think the Supreme Court decision basically, you know, ignores those kinds of, you know, situations where corporations really represent a special case in terms of the kind of concentration, their insulation, I think, from the basic political processes. And yes, I think there are some countervailing forces and some new challenges that this creates. For example, in the Latino community, for example, of trying to organize to hold the corporations accountable, they obviously see us as a major market that they would not want to offend. I don't think they're going to go out of their ways to create problems, but yet, it's not a group that we really have a lot of accountability.
Well, let's let Linda Chavez respond here. Linda, it just does seem, I mean, Angelo's point that Latinos as a group, and there are certainly exceptions, tend to be, at this point in our history, lower income than other groups. African Americans, of course, you know, we know the data there, that there's a sort of a wide range of sort of identities in both of these groups, but on average, they tend to earn less. So isn't it sort of intuitively obvious that they would have less ability to negotiate their interest if money is the main vehicle by which their political interests are advocated? I mean, doesn't it seem intuitively obvious that it institutes an imbalance in the system?
Well, I think Angela sort of glided over the point that, in fact, Latinos are a huge market in the United States. They represent a very large part of the market in the United States for consumer goods. And therefore, they do have power. They have power in the way in which they spend their money. And because there are choices available in most things. If you found a corporation taking a position that Latinos found not to be in their interest, they could, in fact, engage in boycotts, simply avoid buying the products of a company that whose behavior they didn't approve. But I want to get back to the point of this idea that somehow corporations have this huge influence in American politics. If you look at the Center for Responsive Politics, which is a left-of-center organization, but one that does a very good job of tracking political spending and who gives what to whom, and you look at the top donors in the United States, the top political donor in the United States is the National Education Association. It gave in the 2007-2008 cycle $56 million to politics. There isn't a corporation that comes close. The only association of realtors, which is the number six ranked, gave only $28 million. And there was not a single corporation on here. Obviously, corporations don't give direct political contributions, but their individual members who work for those corporations, their executives, et cetera, do. And when you look at the way in which those executives actually donate their money, they are much more likely to try to split the baby down the middle, giving both to Democrats and to Republicans. So this idea that somehow corporations speak with a single mind, that they're going to use their money in ways that are somehow not in the interests of their shareholders, I just think is naive and does not recognize that corporations are, in fact, aggregates of individuals.
Okay, well, this is an interesting topic, and we'll have to revisit it perhaps right around the midterm elections. I thank you both for joining us. Linda Chavez is the chair of the Center for Equal Opportunity. She joined us on the line from her home office in Virginia. Angelo Falcone is president of the National Institute for Latino Policy. He joined us on the line from his office in New York. I thank you both for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.